Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Mermaids in Paradise opens with a couple from LA, Deb and Chip, deciding where to go on their honeymoon. Chip, for whom life is incommensurate with the chivalric world of his video games, wants something adventurous. Volcano bicycle camping, perhaps? Snowshoeing on glaciers? Ruined Cambodian temples? But in the end, Deb steers them towards something more conventional, a stay at a resort on a Caribbean island. Their honeymoon takes an unexpected turn, however, when a marine biologist they meet shares a startling discovery: real-life mermaids. In spite of this element of fantasy, Lydia Millett's novel is very much anchored in a recognizable present. It's a satire of our politically divided culture, in which mermaids become further fodder for the culture wars. And the mermaids have a kind of realism to them as well. Here is Deb reflecting on her impression of a mermaid that she briefly sees up close. "I'd gotten a long gander at her features. What had struck me about them was the details. They were the features of an actual person. They weren't generic. They were just eyes, a nose, a mouth, all specific and real." Once word leaks out about the mermaids, the parent company of the resort hatches a plan to capture them. They want, of course, to monetize them by featuring the mermaids at the resort. After the biologist goes missing, Deb and Chip join forces with some of their fellow guests to save the mermaids. Many plot twists ensue. I wanted to discuss this book as part of our exploration of mermaids because, well, first of all, I just love this book. And also because of the clever ways it uses mermaids to address our environmental crises. In my view, Lydia Millett is one of the most interesting writers working at the intersection of fiction and environmentalism. She's not what one would call a nature writer per se, yet her books both express a love for the natural world and find unexpected ways to expose our failure to take care of it. She's written over a dozen novels and story collections, many about ties between humans and animals and the crisis of extinction. She also has a fascination with the apocalyptic, and you know how I feel about that. Her story collection Fight No More received an award of merit from the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 2019, and her collection, Love in Infant Monkeys, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. She's also a person who's thought extensively about the intersection of culture and nature, which is, of course, my preoccupation in this podcast. So it was a great pleasure to talk to her. Her audio, I warn you, is a bit uneven in parts, but what she has to say is so interesting, I don't think it matters. I should also warn you that we do give away big chunks of the plot. So a friend of mine actually convinced me to do a short series on mermaids. She thought that it would be a fitting topic for my podcast, and I immediately wanted to do your book because I enjoyed it so much. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, I wish I could talk to her about it because I was really taken aback. I hadn't read any of your books before. It was recommended to me. I actually posted on Facebook looking for something fun to read, which is not something I often do. Somebody I don't know very well said, oh, read this, you know? Mm-hmm. And so initially it reads almost like a beach read, you know, which is part of what's so kind of bewitching about it. And it's very funny. And then before you know it, you're in deeper waters than you expected. So I really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed rereading it for this interview as well. So I want to start with why mermaids. I'm curious what inspired you to write a novel with mermaids in it, if there was something in particular.
Well, yeah, it's funny talking about this book again, because of course I haven't been interviewed about it for years since it came out, essentially. And I've just, you know, I can no longer spout talking points about it as I once might have been able to. So perhaps this will be more authentic than usual. So essentially, I mean, I, first of all, who's not fascinated by mermaids? I have always liked the idea of them and also being horrified by these sort of like beautiful monsters that really are sort of unholy in certain ways, and also enchanting, and also they're linked to sort of the natural world, manatees and sirenia, you know, the order of mammals to which I think manatees along, all of that, the sirens, you know, all sort of the mythology surrounding mermaids is pretty captivating. And their odd sexualization and desexualization that's simultaneous is interesting to me. In this book, really, they were the sole sort of magical element. And I wanted that, you know, deus ex machina kind of absurdist entry into the mundane, you know, the everyday life of the honeymooners. And I thought that mermaids were appropriately magical and ridiculous simultaneously. So, you know, it was also a way to write about the sort of convergence of the natural world and the supernatural and the ways in which we imprint our own imaginations onto the wild.
Yes, I want to come back to that last point. I like the idea of them as a deus ex machina. On the one hand, the book sort of naturalizes mermaids, but on the flip side, the mermaids render what seems like a more ordinary story. I don't know if supernatural is the word, but it sort of tweaks the tone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and I'm sure you remember these mermaids are not, they aren't sort of archetypal lovely mermaids brushing their hair, right? They're sort of de-romanticized mermaids. And we don't
see...
Yeah,
they have bad teeth, for instance.
Yeah, right, right. They're more like sort of feral mermaids, right? And that was fun to play with, too. And important to me that they not be these sort of stock images, sort of sexualized. You know, of course, archetypal iconic mermaids have tails instead of legs, which, like in the very sad fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen, you know, relegates them to sort of a life of lesserness on land, right? Or a sort of misery when they're transplanted out of their natural element of the ocean. So they, you know, they're kind of these odd, they're hybrids, they're hybrid monsters. And
well, I was wondering if, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was wondering if the hybrid nature of them, human, non-human animals, was one of the things that interested you about them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I've always been kind of drawn to hybrid beasts and deities and our kind of, I don't know, our yearning to sort of combine the human with the animal and what that looks like in our myth and in our art and the odd sublimeness of it and also the jarring, perhaps horror of it, right? That those two things can exist simultaneously.
Right. So there's a contingent in the book that is deeply troubled by the mermaids because of this hybridity. I'm going to quote you every once in a while because I can't resist it and because I think the listeners will enjoy it as well. So there's this sort of right-wing contingent that when word gets out about the mermaids, thinks that they are possibly the descendants of Lucifer. And there are different theories as to why mermaids are evil. And one of them is that they are the result of bestiality. So this is the passage I wanted to quote. You write, "These people had convictions. No one could argue against that. They didn't agree on the how, but they agreed on the why the tails gills had happened. On that front, they were perfectly united. It was the bestiality aspect. The crime was loving animals, whichever way you sliced it," they said, which is just hilarious and just one of these very revealing moments. So it's interesting you bring into a contemporary context, I think, this theme that, you know, you can go back in Shakespeare, for instance, and see the troubling aspects of bestiality and the allure of it, too. But here you're putting it into a sort of a contemporary political context.
Yeah. Yeah. And that book was written sort of, I don't know, it seems a long time ago now, but I guess everything sort of telescopes finally and things that seem of the moment now were already of the moment then. Of course, it was only a few years ago, but still so much seemed to have changed in the interim, but we still have that same culture war.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's more than ever, right? Yeah,
more than ever.
It feels really prescient or, you know, anticipating things that are going to get even more intense.
Yeah, the sort of exaggerated nature of the sort of, yeah, constant ramping up of it.
Yeah. So the other thing I wanted to talk about, the ways in which mermaids in your story and the setting speak to climate change as well. One of the things is that you set it in the Caribbean. And although climate change as a theme emerges indirectly, the first time it comes up is in an argument between two guests at the resort, it's kind of implicitly there because it's set in this fragile ecosystem. There's this kind of awareness of the fragility of the reefs in particular. I was wondering, first of all, if that was one of your motivations for setting the story in the Caribbean, and also if you see mermaids as an interesting way to engage with the subject of climate change.
Let's see. Well, first, the Caribbean, I like writing about tropical islands because, you know, in the same way, I guess people like writing themselves into any place that they can't be or aren't, whatever. It's just, it's a nice place to exist for a while, even if it's only in language. And I'm sort of like chronically fascinated with the tropics and with the sort of abundance of life there. And also the way we romanticize, much as we do with mermaids, sort of the tropical life. So mermaids in the tropics seem to go together, or mermaids in the subtropics also, I guess. And then, of course, you know, the reefs are to such a huge degree on the front lines of climate change. Yeah, I really did want to write, you know, even in passing about the reefs. But they're such an iconic climate change victim, and it's all happening so fast with them. So, yeah, it seemed apt to write about them. You know, I wasn't really thinking of mermaids in terms of climate change, more mermaids in terms of our relationship to other creatures and our ways of acting toward other wild things, really. I mean, that I was sort of more with the mermaids tending to think about extinction. But of course, you know, extinction and climate change are entwined. And even in this satirical book, they're necessarily entwined.
Yeah. The one way in which they overlap in the narrative or come together is there's a speculation at one point that the reason that the tourism industry is interested in mermaids is because they're aware that the coral reefs are dying because of climate change, and they're worried that they won't have something to attract tourists to the Caribbean, and so they imagine that mermaids will maybe replace them.
Yes, you're bringing this whole book back to me, as you describe it.
I can just keep reading quotes. And
exactly, and I'll remember. Yeah.
Okay, here's a good one. Without the coral reefs out there, we don't have shit. Sand, water, you can get that boring crap in Florida. Hell, even in New Jersey. So, it's dark.
Yeah.
So, mermaids, you know, we've talked about the hybridity, them being sort of half human, half other animal. And so they're these interesting figures in that way. At the same time, they also come out of stories, right? Out of human stories. And there's so much about storytelling that I thought was really interesting in the book. Towards the end of the novel, Deb says, "I wish there were some perfect retreat for those whales and those mermaids, the beauty we knew, the beauty we thought we'd made up or maybe only dreamed. We'd never been quite sure," which seems almost to call into question whether or not the mermaids are real in that moment. But it also seems to suggest that the mermaids are a figure for the beauty that we experience in the natural world. So I'm curious about, I guess, the role of storytelling in that access to the beauty of the natural world.
There are things about the kind of act and resonance of storytelling in many of my books, and this one certainly, because mermaids are mythical, and I've sort of placed a mythical thing in the midst of something with some level of verisimilitude, a quasi-realistic setting, it's a very self-conscious device, you know, and so it's sort of very, very openly addressing our mythologizing of the natural world and of ourselves, right? At the same time, right. the way we tell these stories, I think, lose our grip very easily on what's fact and what's fiction in a way. Even in a best case scenario, when we are not confused about literal facts as a culture, we still become confused about the line between the stories we tell and the lives that we live. You know, we mistake the stories for the lives, or we mistake the lives for the stories. And there's there's so much porousness and permeability between those two things. You know, we're constantly trying to live in the story that we tell about ourselves and constantly failing also to live up to that story. So yeah, this book wants to play with the idea of the mythic and the sort of grittiness of our confrontation of it. And so the mermaids here are these, they're the opposite of the mermaid on the cover of the book, right? They are more like our real selves than the selves we project onto movie screens and into social media. Even though they're imaginary, they're more sort of like the real than almost some of the characters in the book are. But at the same time, we only see them really fleetingly, and so we can't ever pin them down. We can't ever fully know what they are. They're elusive even though they've been spotted, right? They've been glimpsed, but not known. And I think there's something, always to me, there's something really interesting in what we don't know about what we see in the natural world. You know, like the space between what we know and what we don't know is sometimes sort of like a seemingly infinite space. And it's kind of what makes life worth living, is actually not knowing parts of the universe, right?
And yeah, to me, that's part of the difference between seeing an animal in captivity, for instance, and seeing an animal in the wild.
Yes, because once we have an animal in captivity, we have made a hybrid monster of it, right? So the animals we see in zoos, they have the bodies and the neurology maybe of their wild counterparts, but we have, you know, robbed them of their culture, stripped them of their society, and really they're almost just symbolic representatives of the actual animal species of which they are a part.
Yeah, I'm struck by what you described in terms of the not knowing, you know, how that mystery is so much what gives meaning to the world.
I think so. I think that it would be terrible to live, much as I love science, of course I love science and I love discovering things, but I also don't think I would ever want to live in a fully known world. That would be like not being alive at all, really. If there were no mystery, I think that would be a kind of hell, you know, a kind of purgatory anyway.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to come back to storytelling. I have a number of questions about storytelling. One has to do with Chip, who, by the way, is a fabulous character.
I loved Chip. I was like, I'm going to write this like dream husband in a comic vein. You know, he was kind of like a dream husband in a way.
I know. The whole opening sequence that leads up to the wedding is just so funny. And he's great. I mean, you think that he's going to be, yeah, just a comic book character, but in fact, he's not. But I wanted to talk about his fascination with a fictitious mythical past that he gets to explore in video games. Mm-hmm. So I'll read a little passage. This is describing the world, the mythical world of his video games that he longs for. Okay. In that land, flags are flying over tall grass meadows. Men are Vikings, women like ornaments on the prows of ancient ships, their hair long and wavy. Chip's a dreamer, and if he could, he'd make the world a place where questing video games became reality, where he could wear breastplates and a deep battle horn would sound over the white peaked mountains and lush green valleys. I'm struggling not to laugh while I'm reading this. Stags leaping in the woods, fording of streams by warriors and their war horses, decked out in glorious regalia, possibly mythical creatures. I love the semicolon, possibly mythical creatures. Oh, so good. But I mean, as funny as this is, and as much as we laugh, I think at the same time, this longing for a mythical past, there's something real to it that Deb, even though she's more of a realist, shares in some ways. So I'm just curious about what you were playing at with this.
Yeah. I guess Chip, I really wanted him to have this sort of old-fashioned, I don't know if it's more Dungeons and Dragons or more Narnia or what exactly, but this sort of relationship to vague chivalric ideals, but also to be sort of quintessentially modern, And, you know, it's not only that he likes gameplay and like fantasy, but also that he wants sort of to be epic in his own life and do epic things. And at the same time, he is not living in a context for that, you know? So he sort of has these epic dreams, and also the way that he attempts to live them out is like tough mutters, you know?
Right.
So he's sort of a man who's, he exists in this like, you know, middle class coastal California culture, but in his mind, he may be a hero of, I don't know, of Nightly Times, or, you know, or any other sorts of like times made up or historical in which you can be heroic and, you know, be a vessel for the salvation of innocence, basically, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, Deb is like quite the opposite. She's really quite skeptical and can be very mean and biting, and Chip's kind of this open-hearted kind of Labrador retriever kind of guy, you know? And so I thought it would be quite amusing to play with both those types in the context of like an encounter with something strange, like a mermaid. What would it bring out, you know?
Well, part of what it made me think about is the sense that the world and our actions are imbued with meaning in a certain way, right? It makes me think of romance, not in the sense of sort of romance novels, but in the old sense of medieval stories.
Yes. Right. Chivalric, exactly.
And you know, the sense of longing for a kind of meaning that is embedded in our actions and in our relationship to the world that is clearly missing in some way from this contemporary reality, and this desire to recreate this in some way, which in a funny way they get the opportunity to do in their quest to save the mermaids, although at the end of the day that gets kind of stripped away in some ways as well. On the subject of stories, so the novel has different kinds of stories in it, even stories nested in stories. So, for example, the chapters are titled Newlyweds, Honeymoon, The Murder Mystery, and Glorious Revolution. And then bracketing all of it is an apocalyptic story. It seemed to me that the novel, in some ways, was about storytelling and the ways in which storytelling either hinders our understanding of the world or possibly helps it. And I was wondering if you would agree with that.
Well, I just think I've been writing about this actually in a nonfiction book I'm working on, but just, you know, the degree to which we organize our consciousnesses through story is, you know, it's hard to overstate. We can't really exist without story. So kind of to speculate about whether it's more destructive or constructive, I think to storytell is almost beside the point, because we're such,
right,
you know, obviously meaning-making machines or whatever, but really like storytelling machines, and just can't really proceed without, at least now, some kind of linear structure to follow in our imaginations and in our daily lives. Obviously, I do think the nature and the content of the stories that we've told has become increasingly a problem for us in various ways. And, you know, people talking about climate change and extinction now often talk about the need to tell new stories or tell stories in different ways. And I think that is a need that we have, that we are suffering from the really quite specific and limited content of the stories that we, the sort of mainstream and most powerful stories that we tell in the culture, are really these stories of the self. You know, very little has to do with the collective or the community or, say, philosophy or politics or any sort of things on the macro level are a very distant sort of scenic background to stories of selfhood and domestic stories and just really kind of hero narratives that Chip is kind of interested in, but he's interested in a, I think, less egotistical way than is perhaps average. Like he's actually quite gentle and not particularly self-centered, but I think in the culture in general, that the hero stories that we're fixated on have kind of let us down, you know, in concert with various other forces like capital, have really let us down a difficult road.
Yeah, and I think also the backdrop or this assumption of certain kinds of stories, hero stories, for instance, is a certain worldview, perhaps mm-hmm. in the case of these heroic stories, of a kind of permanence, you know, of a kind of almost like a medieval world of endless regeneration. And that's not a backdrop that really is very convincing to us nowadays. On the other hand, so you talked about linear stories at one point, and that made me think about, I did a few episodes on the apocalyptic, and I spoke to the theologian Bernard McGinn, mm-hmm. and he was very interesting on the topic of the apocalyptic, because he said that he thinks that in some ways, and he's not the only one to make this argument, but that stories in the West are very much modeled off of the apocalyptic, in the sense that the apocalyptic has a beginning, yeah. and a middle, and an end. So I was, and it seems like you have a real interest in the apocalyptic. So I'm curious about what draws you to that genre.
Well, so I have been writing about this too, and as you say, it's not a new idea at all, but I think that many people sort of take for granted this conception, this very linear sort of, you know, Book of Revelation sort of imprint that we kind of overlay our storytelling imaginations with. I think people take it for granted and aren't sort of less aware than they could be of how time used to be cyclical and circular in different ways, or a spiral, but like non-linear, and how much the Judeo-Christian narrative has sort of overtaken our way, even those of us who don't practice either of those faiths or versions of them, you know, have been overtaken by this linear conception of time and history that we sort of also embrace in our own personal lives. I'm interested in the apocalyptic sort of sublime, and also just like the sublime in general. And I've been sort of preoccupied with that for many books now. I've just sort of written about it in different ways. But I do very much think that the replacement of the cyclical with the linear in the way that our cultures now think is tremendously important.
I agree. Yeah, I very much agree. And it becomes a chicken and an egg kind of thing, too,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where, yeah. you know, there are so many things nowadays that seem to confirm our sense of, if not an apocalypse in a biblical sense, at least the sense of impending doom. But at the same time, we are culturally already set up to think of events trending mm-hmm. in that linear way. It's a very interesting question.
And I think also there really are sort of like psychological, sociopolitical dimensions to that involving a sense of futility or hopelessness, or sort of the inexorability of that linear narrative. Those things also, I think, are often perhaps pernicious in the way that we are responding sort of collectively, psychically, to these crises that are before us now.
Yeah. So, but in this book, you do, in a sense, embrace the apocalyptic. One thing I wanted to ask you about is there's a kind of telescoping from the individual to the cosmic that happens in the book that I find really striking. It starts through the introduction of a kind of apocalyptic leitmotif, almost. So, for example, early on, Deb is ruminating about her mother-in-law and her mother-in-law's relationship with her husband. She says, "It's oddly comforting that a nurse ratchet harpy could raise a man like Chip. If a man like Chip can emerge sane and whole from 18 formative years with a nurse ratchet harpy, there's hope of redemption for each and every one of us. There's hope the sun may not burn out after all, some billions of years hence, transforming into a giant fireball that obliterates the planet." I mean, first of all, you've got to admire Deb's the way that Deb's mind works. So I'm curious about, I mean, this seems like something that, I don't know, maybe this is indicative of the way that your mind works as well, but I'm curious about what attracts you about that sort of telescoping, sort of going from the individual to the familial to all of a sudden we're on a cosmic level.
Yeah, you know, I think I've been I've been a sort of chronic offender in that with my books. Sort of. And I sometimes, move from the close up to the far horizon without stopping kind of in the middle distance. You know, there's sort of levels at which you can describe or see or tell or perceive. You know, I sort of sometimes toggle between extremes because I am sort of a person of extremes, just sort of fascinated by extremes, not necessarily in my, you know, daily routine, but, you know, with my kind of interests and as a reader as well as a writer and stuff, I've always liked extreme self-expression and like extreme self-unawareness. I'm very drawn to characters who are extremely self-aware, who have these massive blind spots. All of us have, you know, of course, blind spots, and sometimes don't even know what they are for all of our lives, what our own blind spots are by definition. We don't even know where in the car that we're driving of our own character and personality. We don't even know where the blind spots actually are, much less what is in the blind spot.
Right.
So I've been just persistently interested in characters with particularly large blind spots that are visible to others, you know, sort of visible from space, but never in the mirror. And so extremeness is a sort of an extremeness of character, but also sort of extreme toggling between, I guess, the microscopic and the telescopic or something like that.
Yeah. You know, you were talking earlier about the story that's just the story of the hero or the heroine, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are drawn to these. But it strikes me as a way of reminding us that the narrative is not just about the individual. You know, it's sort of, you put us in a completely different sphere.
Yeah, and I do like to sort of, people were, with this book, some readers were very disgusted by the ending. They're very angry. I got some, like, angry letters about the ending because there was this intrusion. I guess that was the real deus ex machina in the book, really. It's this sort of last-minute intrusion of an unanticipated element. Although, as you say, it was sort of foreshadowed, but this element of celestial kind of foreboding right at the end of the book, people were quite dismayed by this. But to me, I mean, it's quite, I do often, not in all of my books, but in many of them, I'd like to have this like one object that doesn't seem to belong, you know, and in this one, there was kind of a double instance of that, where first there are the mermaids and then there's this other element at the end, just briefly alluded to, but both of those things are intrusive and don't really fit into the world that they're being shoehorned into. And I like that because I like the way that it introduces the mind that's reading the text in a different way into the text, into the blank spaces between the words. I like that sort of disgust of readers. I'm not bothered by it. I like it. I kind of welcome that. Because I think it can be a very soporific reading, and like immersion in narrative can be a very soporific thing. It can be very affirmative, very affirming of worldviews and stuff. And I'm not particularly interested in that kind of affirmation. So for me, it's always, although I don't do this in every book, but often sort of in the more sort of playful books or the more sort of speculative books, like abstractly kind of playful, I will sort of introduce something unwelcome in its kind, you know, like a, you know, piece of fruit in a bowl of nails or something, you know, something that doesn't seem to belong because of the shock of that sort of dissonance. I do kind of enjoy it.
Yeah.
Not just for the sake of the shock though, for the texture of it kind of, and the space that it opens up, I guess.
So let me read you another quote. I'm curious whether this final deus ex machina is partly an attempt to deliver a completely different kind of narrative. So this is Deb talking about when she was a child. So she says, when I was a child and got scared by a TV show or movie, my mother used to say to me, it's not real, darling, it's just pretend. I'd love when she said that. I willingly believed everything bad was made up only for entertainment. Nothing was real. Nothing real was terrifying. So this idea that, what I love about that is this idea that terrible things happening in fiction is comforting on some level because it contains it within the covers of the book or, you know, that whatever the framing device is. So I'm wondering if the ending, the surprise ending, is partly in order to kind of skewer that expectation.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Okay. And I do think also you were talking about the apocalyptic. I've been writing about this as well, and obviously not the first person to do so at all. But the predilection for the apocalyptic in this, you know, absurd kind of writ large format that we've like seen in Hollywood over, well, decades, really. But, you know, all these different genres of apocalypse that are constantly being trotted out in movies and stuff. Some somewhat tenable, others completely fantastical, you know, zombies or whatever, giant King Kongs or Godzillas or whatever. Or would it be King's Kong? Anyway, you know, I think very much those kinds of apocalyptic proxies are comforting because they are impossible and elsewhere, largely impossible and always elsewhere. And in the same way that listening to like murder podcasts, I mean, sometimes like if I'm driving and I have a lot of driving to do because I live out in the desert and, you know, the children go to school in town. So I often am driving just through the desert and listening to the radio. And if generally I listen to, you know, the BBC and National Public Radio and stuff. And over the past couple of years, it's been so oppressive sometimes to constantly be hearing the news. It's just been more oppressive than even then previously. Starting, you know, in 2016, it became significantly more tangibly oppressive to me to hear the news all the time. And so I would actually sometimes go to like headline news, which is, you know, super cheesy true crime stuff, just these like stories of murders and stuff, and it actually would be comforting. And I think because it's just like this has already happened, right? This has already happened. And that's not even fiction. That's like nonfiction, you know, except in the way it's told, it's like absurdly dramatic and follows this template. You know, but it is like a genre. It's a genre of tragedy that we find it very easy to stomach. Crimes against persons. We're very interested in them. It's ghoulish, but it's also just so much more controllable than crimes against entire countries of the kind that we're witnessing now. They're very difficult for us to assimilate.
Understandably so.
Small stories. Yeah, and they should be, right? But whereas small stories are not.
Yeah. But I agree with you. I think that the British mystery novel in particular is really about containing the chaos and bringing it back to order, right? So I thought mm-hmm. it was interesting in that respect that there is a murder mystery embedded within your novel as well.
Right, the idea that sort of like that finally it's a legitimation of the status quo when a murderer is identified, that somehow the naming of the crime or the criminal, it's comforting, but it's like it almost equates to like an approval of the status quo, legitimation of the system in which it exists, right? And like, but even though the person's still dead, right? The murder victim is still dead.
No, it can be very grisly, but I think like of Agatha Christie or something like that, where you have the detective and the whole social cultural setting of the discovery of the murder, but then the sort of painstaking process of making sense of it.
Right.
To me, I read that as it's not just that I find that comforting personally, but that that's really what the genre is designed to do.
Absolutely.
Most frightening.
Yeah. And, but also to say, I think also to say, you know, we live in a world where reason is primary, you know, and reason can solve our problems, even though actually reason only explains the problems, doesn't actually solve them, right? Like it explains who the murderer is in this case, but it does not reanimate the corpse, you know? But anyway, yeah, totally agree on the function of those. And I think even to some degree, you know, crime novels, it depends on the, you know, there's so many different incarnations, right? And subcategories and stuff that, but many, I think, still do what Agatha Christie and P.D. James and folks like that did back then.
Yeah, I agree. So I wanted to ask you a couple of things about towards the end of the novel. So first of all, even though Deb and Chip try their hardest in some ways and they have a whole gang around them and they do all this good work, in the end, they're revealed to be pretty much useless against these larger forces that are at work. Although I won't reveal everything in the end, but it's not all bad what happens either. But again, this is another thing that Deb says. She says, on the one hand, she's sort of summing up people, what she's sort of learned about people at this point. On the one hand, you had the religious hysterics, obesely advancing with their ignorance. On the other hand, to oppose them, all you had was some thin effetes from the city hiding behind a flimsy row of high irony deflecting shields. And she has this best friend who is the kind of epitomization of irony as the, as the ultimate weapon.
Gina. I love Gina.
Yeah, she's great. So, and towards the end, she has this anxiety that is human civilization in its most fundamental aspects, going back to human language itself, that has, in a sense, doomed the natural world. And she wishes it were impossible to undo this. And it made me think, are you familiar with David Abrams' The Spell of the Sensuous? Do you know that book?
Yeah. He actually spoke at this Dark Mountain retreat thing I went to in England. But yes, I've read him as well.
Anyway, it made me think about that. And I was wondering, this is in a sense more a question for you personally than about the book, but how you reckon with this, you know, there are real philosophical pieces to this novel too, about, you know, this question of, have we doomed ourselves sort of? And part of the reason I'm asking you too, is because I feel like you're working through some of these questions through the writing.
Yeah. It's the only way I know how to think is by writing anymore. But yeah, I mean, so the part of Abrams and some other sort of scholars that I don't really cleave to is the part where oral storytelling is somehow morally or culturally or socially superior to the written word. I don't really believe that language has damned us. I believe that the abuse of language is damning us. You know, I don't think it's about whether it's written or whether it's spoken. I don't kind of have a back to the fireside storyteller dogma myself, although I'm not sure if Abrams fully has that. I'm not an expert on him, but you know, I've read some thinking that tends that way. So I don't really. I mean, obviously, language is this remarkable force, and you know, really almost impossible to overstate the importance of it. You know, one of my books, another book of mine, not Mermaids, one called Sweet Lamb of Heaven, really sort of focuses on language and God and ideas about how those two things might be enmeshed, how God might be thought of as language or language might be thought of as God in certain ways. And so anyway, all to say that I am really fixated on language in my own like layperson, not academic fashion. But yeah, I find it problematic to assert that language by itself has doomed us. I think rather it is our distortion and debasement of language that endangers us all so much.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as I understand it, Abrams' argument is that it's the development of the modern alphabet, specifically the Greek alphabet, sort of alienated us from our contact with the natural world. But I don't think the conclusion is, you know, we shouldn't write, we should only tell stories.
No, that's right, absolutely. But there is definitely, there is, like in Dark Mountain and some other sort of movements going on, there is this idea of a return to oral storytelling.
Yeah. Well, for the record, I think we should keep writing books. So,
thank you.
So, on the one hand, as I said, humans are revealed to be, in some ways, the problem in the book. In another way, I felt like Mermaids in Paradise was about human love of the natural world. And I was wondering if you would agree with that. I have another Deb quote. She says, "Still, there were instants when it pierces me, it pierces all of us. We all have those instants of remembering, a terrible love that passes in a flash, our terrible love of everything."
Yes. Of course, it is also about, even through the filter of Deb, who's this sort of harsh and judgmental character, there still is this thing that she rarely refers to, which is this, like, you know, genuine sort of wonder that underlies all her sarcasm.
I mean, one of the things that's wonderful about having her be the filter is it makes the book really not dogmatic in any way. I mean, not that your books are that way.
Right. No, it's a sort of like, also for me, just made me laugh. I have this like thing where sometimes I just like write, you know, these voices that actually make me personally laugh to myself in a sort of unbalanced way, you know. And Deb was a voice like that for me. She just kind of amused me, like sort of entertained me more or less constantly as I was doing this book.
I mean, I'm so grateful to any author who will make me laugh.
Me too. I'm so happy whenever I find one who does.
There aren't enough of them somehow.
There aren't enough. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And some of the best who really can just slide this like incredibly funny thing into, I wish they would do it more often. Some who are really talented at that. There's almost like in serious writing or whatever that might be, but you know, in sort of literary fiction, I almost feel there's like a fear of humor at times.
Yeah.
You know, in contemporary American fiction specifically.
No, I agree.
Because it's either like it's fraud, and so my books like were traditionally sort of divided into those two categories where some were satirical like Mermaids, and then others were, you know, solemn. And I think that ideally these things should be able to be married to each other.
To do both, absolutely. So, you know, spoiler alert, I feel like I have to go back to the asteroid briefly. So mm-hmm. I'm just curious, why an asteroid?
It's funny, this was like years before that Don't Look Up.
Yeah, movie, I was wondering right? if you saw that.
I know. I was like, I wrote about that. In a very, very similar vein, where it's just clearly a proxy for the climate crisis, you know? And also because I'm just, you know, I'm always interested in the matter of extinction. And of course, the last major extinction came about that way. And so it just was the deus ex machina. And it's so irrefutable and kind of like just simple. And I was just drawn to that. I didn't want it to be a complex idea. I wanted it to be the simplest, briefest shorthand possible.
Yeah. What did you think of Don't Look Up? I'm just curious.
You know, I was really drawn to it. And at times, like, I loved the scene. I guess it's not the last scene, but I loved the scene at the dinner table near the end.
Yeah,
I thought that was really beautifully done. And some of the other stuff was like weirdly broad, and I kind of felt like it was a kitchen sink situation sometimes. But I appreciated very much the intent. I appreciated the intent of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it got criticism. One of the criticisms it received was that the asteroid was not a good analogy for climate change. But to me, that sort of missed the point. I felt like what it allowed the movie to do was to show the denialism that can happen and the politics and all the silliness, you know, that attends.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'm also not sure that asteroids aren't, because I mean, the sort of main argument is that it's not something over which we have agency. But actually, if you are, the whole deal, obviously, with climate change is time scales, right? And policy and political will and everything like that. That's the crux of the problem, really, because it's not technology, it's political will, right? And it's, you know, capitalism and things like that, little things like that. But but also with asteroids, if you spot them, you know, far enough ahead in time, at least this is what various sort of think tanks and projects and like Palo Alto think, seemingly. But, you know, you can actually do something about them if you plan ahead, right? So they are sort of in their own way, potentially, also a time horizon.
Right, right. No, that's a good point. So tell me a little bit about this project, the book that you're working on right now.
So I'm actually working on three books right now. The one that I was just talking to you about is kind of the hardest book I've written, and because it's nonfiction, it's the hardest for me because I'm only accustomed to writing nonfiction in sort of short forms, you know, like essays or op-eds or things like that, not whole books. And so this one really it's about extinction, and it's sort of vaguely started as a sort of bestiary, but also it's sort of about my own life and my love for my children and that kind of thing. But it's all sort of braided in with thoughts about extinction and religiosity, and more than anything, actually storytelling and how we relate to stories.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to reading that. So you said three?
Oh, good.
Three?
Yeah, yeah, it's called We Loved It All, but it won't be the next book that's coming out is a novel called Dinosaurs that comes out in, I think, October. It's just a short little novel called Dinosaurs.
Okay. I'll be looking for that one, too. I just finished your latest, A Children's Bible, which I enjoyed very much, too. But that would be a whole
separate
podcast.
Yeah, it would.
We have a number of exciting episodes coming up. If you have an idea for an episode that you would like to share with me, please email me at askwith, that's askwith@intheweeds.gmail.com. In the meantime, if you have a moment, please leave In the Weeds a positive review wherever you listen to podcasts and tell a friend to listen to In the Weeds. Thank you. We look forward to being back soon.